So are there any of these specific little chapters that you think are more interesting than others that you would want to talk about?
Well, they're all great, and you don't have to read them in order, but take the beginning. It begins with the bald soprano. What's the Ionesco's play, right? Isn't it Ionesco?
Right.
And the play, and McLuhan points out, and he met Ionesco in Paris in the 70s. They became acquaintances. But it's almost there. There's the personal part. He met Ionesco, so he was interested in what Ionesco was doing. He was a talented playwright, so he's going to take what Ionesco had created and fit it into a larger framework that would surprise Ionesco. So he takes the play, and he's doing this right when he's meeting Ionesco. He puts it into his latest book. So look at his books as diaries. So the late 60s is in cliched archetype. So the bald soprano ends with people going around sniffing. Just sniffing. All the characters are sniffing. That's how it ends.
Right.
Right? They're engaging what Marshall called the osmic sense, the smell. And when you're in a tactile environment that's inaudible, invisible, multiple levels, what you see is not real, what you can't see is real, as Ion would say, you're in a perpetual probing like a little muskrat. Or a little rat, or an animal. Sniff, sniff, sniff. We gauge things by sniffing. Now, people call that, in chemical body terms, my intuition, my ESP. And sniff, what is it that, there's a line in there, snooping with intent to creep.
Yes.
Snooping with intent to creep. In other words, you sit there, listen, people are listening to us right now, and they're snooping out what we're saying. They're trying to smell what direction I'm going in, what does my past, what smells of my past leak through. Many people think I've got the stench of McLuhan on me, so they smell that. And they smell all kinds of things as they observe this electrically, discarnately, and they're going to see what movement they can make from what we're saying, movement for us, against us, or to speak or to write on the InQuick message or the chat line. They are going to creep because there's so much going on. Any movement is at best creeping, like a snail. Okay? So snooping with intent, sniffing with intent to creep. So back to you, Katie.
A couple of the concepts that I thought that were mentioned a couple times that were cool was there was that concept of recurso. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, that's the repeat.
Purging, cleansing, rehearsal. Is that the same as replay that we were talking about right at the beginning?
Before I answer it, I'll just say Janet did finally say, she said, the two-way conversation to Bob. Very good. I think that's a good way to say it. Like, I'm speaking on behalf of Katie when I'm saying my parts, because we're talking from the same book, and she can quote me things that I'm thinking of that I didn't say. See, if you're tuned into the same language, to the same perception, you actually, one person can speak for both of you.
Right, yeah, and if you have an ego about wanting your words to be out there rather than just being in agreement, then...
I don't do it out of ego. I do it out of joy.
No.
I like to talk when I have something, it feels like I got something to say, but it's stimulated by the other person. So the other person gets the credit for stimulating me.
Uh-huh.
And maybe Katie will give me credit for stimulating whatever Katie's going to say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an individualist ego thing. It certainly sounds like it. But if you're mature and understand the process, you're not going to be waylaid by that. So then Wendy says, I'm sticking with Carolyn. Her wrath is scarier than Bob's. So there's Wendy playing up the chemical body, the peanut gallery emotion, the emotion of Malta. She's trying to be the little man and play up that little emotion.
And in the meantime, I've swung back to Bob's side.
Yes.
And left Wendy.
Yeah,
sorry, Wendy.
Good point. And then Sky Goddess Sue says, to sniff, perchance, to creep. Yes, I guess that's what Sue is saying, that she creeped by typing that, and she's not sure to say it's creeping. And then Janet says it's a delicate dance. So, again, Katie, they're saying everything you agree with.
Oh,
what
yeah.
What you would have said.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm going to shut up, and you have to lead now. You talk, unless I'm inspired to come in with some new amazing thing that, because of what you said.
Okay. Another little thing that I thought was interesting, I don't even know how to say this word, But the part about cliche is double probe. It's the hendiadys.
These are key points.
How do you say that word?
Hendiadys.
Hendiadys. I was saying it incorrectly.
That means was one by means of two. That's really important. One by means of two. And once I said it to Ion years ago, he started using it, or they use it all the time. One by means of two, so there's a duality in the individual. But also, the definition is that you describe the plate or the cup, and the cup is gold, and then you say, and a amber luster. You add on another descriptive term, which is redundant because it's very much the same meaning as gold. But you add it on. And so that's what we mean by both and. You got the dance between the two conversations. That's the double probe. You're probing both sides. I'm probing you. You're probing me. Even maybe one of us is talking. And that dance has an hendiadys level where something more, but redundant because it didn't need to be said. I mean, if everybody totally understood Finnegan's Wake, nobody would speak. Everybody would just shut up. There's nothing more for speech to say. But because you can't stop it, speech becomes hendiadys. It just keeps adding on and repeating itself. Now, this drives people crazy because everything seems boring. See, if you're a regular news consumer, after a while, all the big exciting threats that news projected over, say, a five-year period, you're going to see that, no, they never really get to the cataclysmic conclusion. And it never, it's like Chinese water torture. It never ends, but they never get to a finish line. That will create, that will frustrate the person looking for a message to be told them in the news. And so they freak out and go to the Bible and start reading, some cult literature about what the future is going to bring because they're trying to find a meaning, all reacting to the fact that the electric age has no finish line. Okay, sorry. Back to you.
No, that's very, I didn't know that. The hendiadys meant both and. I didn't know that.
I'm saying it's the and part. Yeah. I'm saying that.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And part. Yeah. It's something and the and is redundant, but people, it's almost the rhythm comes in. You can say, look at this piece of gold, and you feel like that's not enough rhythm. So you go, look at this piece of gold and glowing amber. You add a few more words to make the rhythm flow better. You notice that Ion is perfect in his rhythm of speech. He'll start saying something, and he's going to end up sort of going in the direction of repeating what he already said, and he finds different words to say what he already said. He does that every time, because if someone starts faltering and just goes back to what they already said, it loses its impact. It loses its freshness.
Mm-hmm.
So Ion is really good, very eloquent in speaking and keeping it subtly interesting as it keeps repeating itself but making little wrinkles of difference each phrase, each paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
So that's hendiadys.
And then there was a section that talked about using Yiddish prefixes and suffixes in words.
Yes.
That I found very interesting, and I noticed that that goes on today, too, in pop culture.
Yeah.
Ish is a suffix that people will often add to a word if they just feel it a little bit. Or they'll just say ish. Like, are you feeling like you'd like to go have something to eat now? Are you hungry? The person might just say ish if they're a little bit hungry.
Yeah. Right. Yiddish is in the interval. Could it be that the Jews are very involved in the culture industries? And so they
mm-hmm.
become a figure of creativity, and then their peculiar dialect of Yiddish fits. You know what I mean? Several factors make
mm-hmm.
it have perfect pitch.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. That's what McLuhan writes about that in the book.
Again,
you're saying things. I've never heard anybody say these points back to me when talking with cliche archetype. Hardly anybody. I never even had any conversations with anybody. Tried to, but they don't. You're again finding good examples in what you're noticing.
Well, good. I also liked there's a little section on cliche the archetype as systole diastole,
yes.
which is actually the rhythmic contraction of the heart. So I thought that was really taking the whole rag and bone shop of the heart and having the cliche archetype flipping would actually be the beating of the heart.
Right, that's right. Because when you look at any surgical imagery of a beating heart, you can't see what's going in and going out at the same time. It's hard to say, oh, it's going in and going out. It sort of blurs in front of you. The in and out are happening simultaneously, so your linear eye can't really go see one direction without the other being implied. You know what I mean? It's almost like a visual pun. So the action of the pumping of the heart implying, was it four ventricles, Carolyn? Four things pumping, accesses?
Two ventricles, two auricles.
Right. That action, look at a tetrad, which is enhance, obsolesce, retrieve, and flip into. Look at it. It's all happening at the same time, like looking at a heart. A heart is doing a tetrad. It's extending itself by bringing new blood in. It's sending blood out. That's obsolescence. It's maybe retrieving some and then pushing to extreme on some level in the heart. So then that is an image of consciousness. That's what your perception is. It's not a mind-body thing. It's at least four parts, your process of consciousness. So, yes, systole, diastole is a very good image of a process that's hard to comprehensively visualize. It involves the other senses. You have to imagine what you're not seeing to understand the action of the heart. If you're just looking at the image of it. So, yeah, that's another very important point. I think you've been cheating. I think you've been listening to interviews with me, and I bring up these points, and you're sucking up to me and find, oh, this is what Bob likes. He likes to talk about systole, diastole. I do that all the time, talk about that. So, why?
Well, I put a little notebook here where you could, I could take a picture of it and send it to you where I took my notes.
All right. So. And you haven't had time. Yes, and you haven't had time to hear my talks about all this stuff because you've only been paying attention for 6 weeks. So, yes, you can plead ignorance in this case. You just know
This is just reading. Just reading.
Right.
Just my little notebook. Okay, then another thing that I thought, and this might be a stretch, but in this whole conversation, especially when you look at the original etymology of cliche and archetype, and that having to do with making copies.
Right.
Now, when we are taking the drops, we're refreshing the copies that we're making of ourselves.
Yeah.
So we're going back to that original perfect archetype.
Okay, look at this. It's a good point. Look at this, Carolyn. With the drops, you create new cells, so that's extending. You obsolesce your old cells. That's the trash removal that Realign does.
Mm-hmm.
It retrieves your awareness of original condition, your ascended or beginning point, and it flips into the opposite. It's going to bring contrast. It's a tetradic process. It may be the first food that shows the tetrad. Because what food creates something new? Nothing creates new like cells. So that makes it even a candidate to be a tetrad. So very good there. See, your idea, you're just probing there, Katie, led to this pattern. Very good.
Oh, good. I thought that
was
good.
That's right. The drops are a tetrad.
Another thing that I thought was interesting was the satellite, Sputnik, whatever, put the world in this proscenium arch.
Proscenium arch.
Proscenium arch. Thank you. I even Googled the word to see what it is.
That was the addition to theater in Shakespeare's time. They invented the jutting out stage, and it created this arch over the stage effect. I mean, you look at proscenium arch, I think, comes from Shakespeare's time. And so the satellites go around the planet and put an arch, put us inside the traditional theater image.
And then that produces an anesthesia, though.
Well, every new extension numbs people.
Okay.
A new environment. It numbs people just from the enjoyment of using it. You know, when you start texting, when kids get their chip body and they're texting, they're engaged in having fun with it, enjoying the content effects of it, and they're not looking at it as a form and relating to other forms. They're totally involved with it. So that can be, paradoxically, a numbing. They're numb to other things. Our whole population is numbed by the chip body the last 10 years by its endless fascination of staring at the little screen, right? That's a collective numbness.
Right.
But it's not a numbness where it doesn't notice what it's perceiving. It is perceiving the content of their texting, but in relation to other media, it's become tunnel vision. It's become a numbing in relation to other environments. So what did you say? How do we get onto that? You started to say...
I was just bringing up another random...
The satellite.
Because in
satellite,
that same chapter... Go ahead. No, let me just say this. In the same chapter... Marshall talked about Freud and Freud using cocaine in part of his
Yeah.
Research and enjoying the manic effects of having taken the drug, but not noticing that the numbing effect when he had rubbed it on his gums.
Right, I thought that was
interesting.
Well, he takes an example of someone using a technology, cocaine, and noticing some things and missing other things. Freud didn't have a comprehensive view of the total array of effects of the drug on himself.
Okay.
So that's a metaphor. That's a personal experience of a famous archetype, and then Marshall used that as a metaphor for how we fail to notice all the effects of the environments we're using.
Okay.
There's always a numbness that sneaks up. Even we obsolesce something in the new effects, and when we obsolete something, we don't notice we're obsolescing it. Like somebody used to say back in the 60s or 70s that in education, the kids were obsolesced, and the teachers never noticed it. They were too busy bringing in new technologies or whatever hyper method of teaching they were bringing in. They didn't know that it didn't notice that it was actually making the kids number, and the kids couldn't keep up. So the kids were obsolesced, even though the teachers were engaging them. They didn't know that their understanding of the education, the teacher's understanding, was numb in relation to the kids. So that's anesthetizing. Yes, the satellite anesthetized everybody. So what did everybody start doing? They start doing their thing because they regarded the whole planet as a theatrical platform. So that's where, why did the phrase come in? It's now a normal phrase, but it was outrageous in the do your own thing. They said, oh, that's a bunch of hippies making some crazy anarchistic statements. But by the 80s, management was telling their employees to do your own thing and be creative here. It became part of the phrase, the language in the speech part of media. The speech world, it became part of that because it was an undeniable effect that the satellite turned everybody into an actor and no spectators, and so you were only left to do your own thing within yourself, sort of like masturbation. Masturbatory, do your own thing with no audience. And that's what people say happened. They say, well, there's no community, no this, anarchy, nobody's decent anymore, nobody's moral. You know, it's hyped and hyped and hyped. And you know what, Carol? I said 20 years ago that the internet was the satellite environment. You know, you get in a satellite and go around the planet if you're an astronaut. Well, that was shrunk gradually by the Android meme, so that when you had your little computer, you now had your own hackneyed satellite vehicle. Well, that got shrunk even more so over the last 20 years. So what do they call the latest form of satellite? iPod. It's a satellite pod. It's right there in the language that they named it pod. Why? Because that revokes the little capsule that the astronaut was in 50 years ago. Isn't that neat?
Yeah.
So the language is always telling you, you know, who gets credit for creating the phrase iPod? You know, some guy in Steve Jobs' plant, or was it a collective thing? It's very interesting. It doesn't matter. The language knew what it had to be appropriate. So the language named itself. Might have used the human being. But it was guaranteed iPod would be the word. Then podcasting. So this is how new media environments affect the older media environments, and it's largely registered in speech. Like, speech is the most tactile, most interesting, flexible technology. It's like the way the Evergreens describe humans. When we first began, we were a little lemur, and we were not a fast runner. We were weak in everything, but we were flexible. This little lemur, you know, evolved supposedly to the ape and then to a human. Well, speech is like the lemur. It's the most easily adaptable technology. It always stays in the game. Do you see what I'm saying, Kate?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is that one part, too. I loved it in the Lovejoy and the Daisy Chain, where it talks about how there's a phrase that every culture has that indicates... I'm reading
that's
it.
Page 136. I've said that 100 times. That's my favorite part. The plenary awareness.
Is it?
Yes, I got most of that page memorized. I've been using it for years.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, you go to page 136. Plenary awareness, which means a total in every culture or language, verbal language, there's a sense of mastery, and there was always a phrase in that culture that exhibited the sensory bias of that culture. But also it was the bias of feeling mastery in that culture, right? So the British say, I know it like the back of my hand. Well, you look at the back of your hand. It's a visual layout. You know, you look at it, and you're British or visually biased culture. So they take, when I know it like the back of my hand, I am really good at mastering whatever the visual dynamics or task is visually, right? So what does the Spanish say? Spanish aren't visually biased. They're proprioceptive inside the gut. I know it as if I'd given birth to it. So the birth process is a sense of is the sensory bias of the sensory mastery that the Spanish have. Mm-hmm. Then the Thailander, I know it like the snake swimming in water. That's the dance of thought among words. And notice that, thought among words, that would be a very primitive, early, pre-technological state, even though speech is a technology. But cavemen are really Aboriginal societies. They only have speech and thought, right, and clothing and a few weaponry. So their sensory bias is the interplay of dance of thought with words, the interplay of the dance of thought among words. And so a snake swimming in water looks like that. A snake is like a tetrad. You know, one part of the body's going one way and the other part's going the other way. It actually could be pentadic. It's only obsolescing and retrieving. So one curve of the snake in the water or ground is curving to the left, to the obsolescence, while the other part of the snake's body is curving to the right, the retrieving. You see what I mean?
This made me giggle, too, because my husband's mother, my mother-in-law, she lives next door to us. She's so funny. I just love her. She had 7 children, and she says about her son, I know him from his little asshole all the way on up to the top.
Now, you know what that is? That's Japanese, because you look at the plenary awareness of Japanese. I know it from head to toe, and the Japanese are masters of the interval. So your mother is following David Byrne and or whatever band it was that said, I'm turning Japanese.
The Talking Heads? Yeah, or was that Talking Heads? I don't know.
I used to think it was, but then someone corrected me. It's another band that does I'm turning Japanese, I think. I'm confused. And I can't remember. I was correct, I think. But someone, augmenter, might correct me. Who did I'm turning Japanese? Is it Talking Heads or some other band? Anyways, the point is, yes, so she is. Now, what is interesting is that she names the body part. She, being an American and visually biased and kinetic biased, she sees the body part. So she says,
right.
What, the ass to the what? What was it?
The little asshole all the way on up to the top. And it also
now, look at that, the little. See, there
it is. Role.
The little is the visually biased, qualifying. The Japanese didn't say, I know it from my little toe to my big head. He just has a larger sculptural profile. I know it from head to toe. Not any particular.
Mm-hmm.
It's the litter person who gets into particulars and saying, like, little asshole. Like, that kid didn't have a little asshole from the kid's point of view, right?
Well, plus,
but it's from the observer's
point of view. She was changing his diapers.
So I know. But,
the bias
but,
of her role, too.
Hey, Neufeld's coming in. We always get glowing reviews from Neufeld. Bob's beautiful mind. That's all that Dave says, Bob's beautiful mind. What about Katie, Dave? What about Katie? Anyways, back, there's a couple of commentaries. So Wendy comes back in response to Carolyn. That's okay, Carolyn. I wasn't taking sides for sake of reason. Just whose wrath is scariest? Ha, ha, ha. So she wasn't even having an opinion. She just was going by, like, that's paranoid acoustic feelings. You know what I mean? When you're responding to the potential effect of Carolyn, not what she says, but her power, her ability to smote people. See, that's almost proprioceptive.
Right.
Okay. And then Augmenter says, it's not Freud's bath, the drivel smears. I think he stumbled Freud. It's not Freud's bath, the drivel smears. Little not linear enough for us. Wendy goes full circle back to archetypes. Then Dave says, the vapors, there's Dave the musician, did turning Japanese. The vapors. So there you have it.
Okay.
The vapors did.
Yeah,
thank
yeah,
you, Dave.
Right.
And then Augmentus is pretty quick there, grass stain. I think he's commenting on Dave. Pretty quick there, grass stain. Oh, yes. Somebody stain. Who had the stain, dope stained mind? Was it Dave or Corbin? Was it Neufeld?
Yeah,
it was a dope stain. So Augmentus is calling Dave grass stain. There it is. Pretty quick there, grass stain. Then Dave says, Katie's massaging beautifully. Yes, you're doing a fine blow job here, Katie. Multi-body blowjob. Because you're blowing. You're using your mouth and air, right?
That's right.
A lot of oral exchange going on. A lot of
that's right.
windy of heights of perspective. So, yes, carry on. Next point. You're finding a good quote. Yeah, so that plenary awareness is really worth memorizing. You know,
loves that.
Now, look at the American. Here's the thing. There's one that says, I know it inside out, and then I think the Germans say, I know it like the inside of my pocket. It's the American that says inside out, right? If you look at that page there, doesn't it say American inside out in the German?
Yeah, I know it inside out, kinetic manipulatory.
Yeah, and I get that. The bias of America is not just a visual culture. It's mainly an industrial culture. In the 19th century, it started to boom ahead. And that's the extension of our muscles. So the Americas are kinetic. And the manipulative part is the cliche about America being the cop of the world. They go around making sure that the old industrial environments are kept organized with the Trilateral Commission at the top, or even the Secret Council 10. So the Americans are forced to be manipulatory because that's what the kinetic is. You put your hands on the environment and you turn the knobs, right? That's industrial. So here's the ugly American, that famous Marlon Brando movie from 50 years ago, is about the... Because all the cultures couldn't handle the tactile extension, they had to become Americanized. They would be more and more industrious. The Third World grabbed on industry. They all became kinetic, and the Chinese super kinetic, and they therefore had to kowtow to the CIA's understanding of manipulating through many means, many media ways, manipulating the environment with their hands-on control. For example, in the 50s, when they started having the atomic bomb, the quote, the CIA, even though it can be an off-the-books group, the commander group went around to all the cultures and said, if you blow up a bomb in New York City or something, we will nuke your whole country, regardless. So they manipulated the situation by just being a cop, and being cop and saying, if you try something on us on a terroristic level, you will have no culture to win. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kinetic manipulatory. That was the effects of the totalitarian effects of the atomic bomb. It created a whole new political dynamic. Of course, now that's obsolete with biological warfare and all kinds of other things, including the digital environment itself, obsolescing the normal working people's economic structure.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So McLuhan said the TV was way more dangerous than the bomb. Well, the Android meme or the digital chip body is way more dangerous to the media environment. It's way more dangerous to TV. Because, you know, by the time in the 70s, TV was the only occupant on the planet, not any human being, chemical body. So just as TV killed the chemical body, the Android, the chip body kills all the former environments.
Right.
Among the machines. So back to cliché archetype. See, once you understand cliché archetype, it's a useful phrase. It's what you're trying to say to people when you have arguments with them and you're pissed off. They sound like they're repeating themselves now, but you know they're saying something new, but it's slightly old, blah, blah, blah. If you just say, well, you're just doing the CA process. McLuhan would go through books and put C, capital C, slash A. That would be its code for cliché archetype. He'd put it all over books. He'd say, oh, this guy's describing the cliché archetype process. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
He'd have, when he talked about decentralized media, he'd have C minus M. That's centers without margins. Everything was centers when it's decentralized. But when you had centers with margins, that's industrial, pyramidical, hierarchical. You got a top and a bottom, and it's contained in a hierarchy. That's C plus M. C with a margin. You have a center and marginal areas at the rim. So you have the city capital and then the outer rubes in the country. That's C plus M, or C slash M. But then you put C minus M, you bring in radio, society decentralizes, and you can be at the center in the country or in the city. Doesn't matter where you are. If you're on the telephone, you're in a C minus M environment. So when you would read, as an archivist, I got to look at Marshall's, his own private texts, his books. He wouldn't have words spelt out. He'd have a few words at the back page, but all through the books he'd have C plus C slash M or C minus M. E-Y-E versus E-A-R. You know, I-ear, center without margins, center with margins. He'd have this shorthand all the way through the books. C-A for a cliché archetype.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this... Tell me this word again, this proscenium, is that how you say it? The proscenium arch?
Proscenium. It's
proscenium.
Yeah, no, it's not okay. I-C-S-C-I, no sh in there, it's N, proscenium.
Proscenium arch, okay. So does that relate at all to all of the without walls statements from Understanding
yes.
Media? Okay.
Yes. Before the satellite environment, you had radio came in, so that was Classroom Without Walls. You had the photograph before the radio. That was, what was the photograph? The Museum Without Walls. So you have
this abundance. He also refers to that as Bravo Without Walls photograph.
Yes, yes, that was one of, that was Jean Genet, the French writer, G-E-N-E-T. He saw the world as a crude brothel. It just, you know, it's just people negotiating on the rawest, uncivilized level. McLuhan would say the photograph made Genet see the world that way. He got overdone by the photograph, the information overload. So you have virtual reality begins. If you don't want to say the alphabet is virtual, though it is, sort of, and if you want to think of modern media as virtual, the virtual reality begins with the telegraph and the photograph, you know, 1850. And then you have the movie, and then you have the television and all the radio, all these different virtual experiences. Each one of them knocks down walls all over the place. But what happens when you take this, and these media, the electric media that knocked down all the walls of, that were created by Gutenberg and previous media, this wall-less world, which is a threat to every culture, which is a walled environment itself, every culture is, I was looking at William Irwin Thompson's five-phase thing. Primitive man, its walls were geared around what you call the sanguino, or blood. The blood, the blood of the tribe is what created the walls between the tribes. Then the next level, moving to Neolithic settlements, agricultural settlements, the next wall was agricultural and territorial, right? So then you bring in writing and the printing press, and the next walls that makes differences between cultures is based on language or linguistic. And then the fourth, when you get into the fourth level, industrial societies 150 years ago, what created walls between cultures and people was your material possessions. No longer your blood or your territory or your language. It was now your material possessions. And then you get into conspicuous consumption by the rich. Then the fifth level, the electric age, what is the thing that creates walls? It's participation itself. As the audience participates in its own participation in making content for the media every day, whether you participate or not determines whether you're in or out. So all these walls were results of the creation of media environments, which are extensions of our senses. So everything from speech to television were extension of parts of our bodies. But when the satellite came along and extended not our bodies but the whole planet, the whole terrestrial environment, that put a new frame around all the previous electric wall-less technologies. So the percent of marriage created a new wall, a new framework. You get that? Because it went around the wall, the classroom over the walls that television and radio created. Now, the television classroom without walls continues. People are still involved with that. They don't see the new effect. They don't see the frame that the satellite created around the planet. And the big effect of putting a frame around the planet was the new feeling for ecology. Now the old terrestrial Earth, which has been obsolesced by the new artificial Earth of the satellites ringing around in a precession arch, it meant the old art, the old Earth became obsolete and soon became an art form, and people wanted to tidy it up, and they started noticing pollution. People lived in pollution 150 years ago and didn't even have a problem with it. You know, it's disgusting from our perspective the way people lived 300 years ago. You know, they just throw shit over their home and out on the sidewalk and fall on people. That was not considered pollution. But once you get into the situation we're in now, then all the old environments were turned into art forms, and they had to be tidied up and redone. And that was noticing pollution everywhere. So the frame around the planet caused by the satellites created the art form of ecology. And a more sophisticated ecology is media ecology. And then once iron shows up, a more sophisticated version of media ecology is paramedia ecology. And that's where we're at now. That's me. I'm not a media ecologist. I'm a paramedia ecologist. I have a world monopoly on the discipline.
Me too.
Did you say me too?
No, I said you do.
Oh, okay, because if you had said me too, here's what's interesting. McLuhan, he was once interviewed by Mike Wallace, the host for 60 Minutes, before there was 60 Minutes. And I have a transcript of it, and it's really amazing because Mike Wallace was a local New York journalist or TV talk show kind of guy before he became famous in 60 Minutes. And I think he even did a game show. So he's interviewing McLuhan, and he says, I've read your books. I'm not sure what you're about. What are you investigating? And McLuhan's first answer was, I'm investigating you. Okay, because he was the media. Mike Wallace is everything. I'm investigating you.
Right.
That seemed quite rude to Mike Wallace, and then the interview goes off in interesting directions. But later, McLuhan says that his work is for people who have a superiority complex. Very interesting. I write for people who have a superiority complex. Now, if you noticed, I don't know what you might look at in the page in the 90s. There's a section on the you done it, not the who done it, but the you done it. If you can find, it's either in the 60s or the 90s, the You Done It. Look for a page at the top where it lists all these book titles. The You Done It inflates the reader, inflates the user of the medium.
Yeah, so on page 90.
Page 90. And he lists all these books, including Wyndham Lewis and these famous books, and they're all You Done It. In other words, they inflate the reader. They discuss culture as if you had a part in it and had a say in it, and you then get inflated. And that's what Marshall meant when he said, I write for those who have a superiority complex. I write for those who are going to dig the you done it factor. Now, Ion's all about you done it, right? You create everything in your reality. He's inflating you.
It's true.
Yep. So you see, if you really know McLuhan, you can come up with a good x-ray of what Ion's saying. You can put a frame around what Ion's saying. Now, I'm not trying to diminish Ion, because Ion operates in non-verbally, but when Ion has to use words with us, he takes the most appropriate words of the present, which have resonance with McLuhan, and I can use verbal analysis to frame what Ion says. I can make a figure ground of what Ion says. Here's a statement by Ion about you create everything in your world. Well, the ground of that is the you done it phenomenon, the you done it medium.
Mm-hmm.
See, so
mm-hmm.
there's a figure ground relationship. So that's a very interesting talent I have on that level. I'm the only one who can figure ground Ion.
You are. And part of this, too, I mean, clearly, Marshall McLuhan is an English professor. I mean, the understanding media showed his vast understanding of history.
Yes.
Cliched archetype shows his vast, I mean, the man has read everything.
That's right.
Everything. Everything.
Now, he may not have read every complete book, but he touched on most books. He looked at them, scanned
right.
them,
mm-hmm.
and he knew how mm-hmm. to, you know, do absorb it fast. Now, also, since Ion says he was a parallel worlder, and so taking that as accurate, he spent a lot of time in other worlds reading a lot. You see what I mean? He could.
Yeah.
He'd only been here when he died, 69 years, but he might have been reading 4,000 years worth. Because he could go to parallel
right.
worlds and take and 20 seconds here can be 3 years over there. So that's actually
right.
an interesting way to look at how could this guy read so much? Well, he's a parallel
mm-hmm.
worlder.
And I don't think, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think very many people, even English majors, read all this stuff anymore. Do you?
No, they don't read. There's a couple of students I met in the 60s, McLuhan students. They hated
mm-hmm.
his oral exploration. He turned into a Socratic dialogue. The baby boomers were the first to demand this. I want to be told what to read and do that. You know what I mean? I haven't got time to read everything or even to think. Just tell me what I have to read that I match with and then answer, regurgitate back in the exams.
Mm-hmm.
More, and that's probably the baby boomer Generation X. I mean, the kids, they don't even know what a book is anymore. They're texting and looking on their multimedia iPod for information. You know, so reading, see, so the whole range of encyclopedic information that McLuhan had is obsolete. Because nobody's going to read that way, and who wants to? You don't even need to read a book anymore. It's irrelevant. Cosmic awareness used to
mm-hmm.
discuss. Stop reading. It's not a viable technology anymore. So that's why Finnegan's Wake is the final book, because it has a book with no content, but includes every possible word and book that ever could be said. Plus, there is interesting patterns that McLuhan translated Finnegan's Wake. So if you got one book, take the Finnegan's Wake. And see, other people, though, if they're Western and visually biased, they go, no, I don't like the, that's too challenging for this week. I'll go with the Bible. And so they become fanatic, literate fundamentalists about one text, the Bible. That's the only reason the religion in that sense came back. Televangelism, which is all on TV, celebrating the one book. It's like, if I can't, if the book's obsolete, I'm going to carry one from them. And so different cultures grab their manuscript or their book, and they make that an archetype, a super archetype. And that's all the cultural battle is over people retrieving obsolete books. The very fact that people became fundamental to show the obsolescence of the book. There's a neat statement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now this is making me think of Fahrenheit 451. Like, what was Ray Bradbury thinking? Did he know about any of this stuff?
No, he didn't.
When he wrote
that
book?
See, McLuhan, I always like to take, McLuhan always be contrary to the cliche interpretation. Okay, Ray Bradbury says books are very important, and it would be a disaster if a totalitarian society burned the books. And, you know, the Nazis tried that in Germany. So book burning, and even the Vatican, their censorship code, whatever it's called, they would censor books. So a literate person has an open mind, wants to engage in all kinds of pages, so thinks the best value is freedom of speech, freedom of reading, freedom of choice. But what happens when you bring radio in the environment, and that makes everybody grab on the new oral dynamic and get pissed off at the obsolescence of books and get mad at books and then start a totalitarian society and burn books? That's the effect of radio. Now, no reading of books prepares you for the effect of radio. So the highest levels of awareness that the book can give you is not adequate to the attack that the electric age brings. You see? So books are limited.
Mm-hmm.
But before the electric age came along, books was the supreme wisdom. Mallarmé, the great symbolist poet, said the world exists to end in a book. The ideal thing was to put it down in a book. So the book got eroded and started burning up, you know, 150 years ago. It's just that the Nazis or different totalitarian societies take a particular bias and get nutty. Now here's the other dynamic. You cannot stop the book. So we have more people witnessing the publication of books than ever before. There's more visual space published than ever before. Not much of it's read, or it's not read in the way old people read it. It's just more and more flourishing of mountains of visual space. McLuhan wrote in the 60s that we'll be flooded. So he's saying the book is obsolete, and people thought he meant, oh, there won't be any books. People won't read them. They won't be able to read them. He meant by obsolete, and you had to study him to figure this out. So he would throw cliche words and have a new meaning, right? Obsolete.
Right.
He knew people had a cliche interpretation of that. Well, he retrieved it as a old cliche or a new archetype and put a new meaning. He said, when he said something was obsolete, it's not influencing anything, so there's more and more of it. So there was more and more books when it was obsolete than when it wasn't obsolete. So you got to look at how he changes the words. And so there's more and more books being made and more visual materials to the point where mountains of it being dumped on us. But it does not form the dynamics of the economy. The economy is formed by digital transfer of information and money credits. That's what molds people's global theater. The book has no say on that level. The book was part of the economy, you know, 200 years ago, but it's not a influential factor in the economy. It's just parallel. When you read a book, you're having a parallel world experience.
Sure.
You're just dropping out and engaging in a little particular weird medium. So what were we saying?
There was a statement in one of the little chapters to the one on casuistry. Is that how you say that word?
Casuistry.
There's so many words in this book that I had to look up,
right,
never
good.
Saw before, and never heard pronounced.
So well, are you complaining? Are you complaining?
No.
Good.
No. No. And I'll say I'm wrong five or six times and not even care.
Right. Now, listen to this. When he was putting together Understanding Media, the publisher said he had too many new, not necessarily new words, but too many new ideas. He says for a book to be successful, can only have 10% new material. McLuhan had 75% new material, basically because he's gone to the other side and was seeing everything backwards. But, you learn five new words from cliché archetype, but even that's considered too much among the industry.
Really? Well, they're stupid.
Well, know what it is. Not stupid. They're post-literate. If you're going to make me read a book, make it easy, make it fast. I'll try to fit a few hours in. You know what I mean? But I got to make a living. I got to do my work. I got to engage in post-literate media. So books are, what are they? They're like a servant that offers some service that is not important anymore. So it sits around on the sidelines waiting to maybe get noticed, and you might want to use its service. That's what a book is. And McLuhan says it in Understanding Media. The book world, the literary world, sat on the sidelines and watched while modern media, electric media, engaged in civil war. And what is the instrument that sits on the sidelines and watches the media engage in the war, the civil war? The banks. So everybody's lashing out at the banksters, and all they are is obsolete and holding together visual space because Americans require visual identity. So the banks preserve visual space. They're not allowed in the game. And so they float around outside of the civil war of media environments to compete with each other for the public's attention. And the bankers are considered, in a pyramidal Gutenberg bias, that they're at the top of the pyramid. No, they're at the bottom. And they kind of can float fancy free. Because it's required, because people require literate identity as a hangover. So there's all there. That just shows you how loud and irrelevant Alex Jones is. He's pointing to the garbage men, to the janitors, to the old obsolete visual medium that just sits on the sidelines.
Wow.
That's a good wow.
That's a good wow. Well, in this chapter, the thing that I pointed out that I thought was remarkable was Well, it talks about this casuistry actually as being
clever. Okay, let me define
clever,
casuistry. But, did you understand that casuistry is the
Let me define it.
Okay, yeah.
I was going to say what my definition is, then you probably have a deeper, better one.
Give your definition.
Clever but unsound reasoning, especially with moral issues.
Well, did you ever see the Beatles movie, The Yellow Submarine?
No.
Okay, well, in it, there's this little muskrat guy. He's a literary critic, and he's going around babbling a mile a minute these incomprehensible big words. That's casuistry. Another, in dialogue, it's, who was that guy who did Firing Line? William somebody, the conservative snob. Did you ever see Firing Line on PBS where Bill Buckley? William Buckley.
Yeah, I was going to say William Buckley. Okay, yeah.
He'd sit there, and he'd look down his nose, and he'd say these very complicated sentences, which was a sign of good breeding in the 19th century, but ridiculous in the fast-paced 20th century. But the Yaleys and the visual banking, visual space addicts, they thought that was a form of culture. So William Buckley was a good example of casuistry. He'd needlessly complicate with his big words his argument over deaths in Vietnam. You see what I'm saying? Casuistry is this pedantic extra stuff. It's partly what you're saying, but remember, it was a sign of important intelligence 150 years ago, but obsolete in the electric age.
Okay, well, this little thing that I wrote down as a note was that Prince is the father of all lies.
Yes.
In that little chapter, they talked about that. So did you have anything you wanted to say about that?
Well, before literacy, see, the alphabet, remember, A, B, C, D, E, these letters don't look like anything. Whereas writing before that looked like a tree. An ideogram would look like a tree. The writing would approximate what you saw. All right? So it seemed to match. There was a verification. But A is in its own little space like a spaceship, having nothing at sounds like and nothing it looks like. So you have to split your mind and you have to read the alphabet and then you have to take those letters and relate it to concrete imagery in your mind, which is a very fast action once you're a literate person and can read. But you have to go through this abstract change of the A, tree, T-R-E-E. It doesn't look like a tree. You have to say T-R-E-E is a scramble bunch of letters that look like a tree. They're supposed to be a tree, right? But it's abstracted, one level removed. So the Greeks start to discuss about truth and lies because they became schizoid because of the effect of the phonetic alphabet. So the truth-lie difference is when you're in a writing society, and especially a phonetic alphabet society. That's why that quote I read you from Dupes, when you're in an electric society where the verbal writing thing is anemic and not very influential – then you don't say someone's lying. You say they have a credibility gap. You can't be so black and white. So the black and white reality came in with the phonetic alphabet, which split the mind into an abstract imagery of letters, whereas if when you looked at a ideogram, it looked like a tree. You didn't have to translate the ideogram into what a tree was because it looked like a tree. It was immediate. It's more direct. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
Right. So the now here's what's really interesting. The abstract effect of the phonetic alphabet on the Greeks, which got them into arguing over what was the ground of existence, motion or absolute stillness. You know, they'd have all these dichotomies that no preliterate tribes ever argue about because they didn't know there was any split. But the phonetic alphabet creates this split. So you have philosophy and debates and the Greek culture and the Greek genius. You can celebrate they made this weird mutation which led to some services. They are split and, I spiraled off like a rhizome in too many directions. I got to get back to where I was going to go with this. The split part of the Greek. Oh, yeah. So this split thing, during the Greek or Hellenic period, H-E-L-L-E-N-I-C, the time of Socrates to Alexander the Great, that 300-year period, is the Greek blossoming of culture and writing and books and poetry and oratory, and Cicero doing law and rhetoric, all that stuff, which is the Greek civilization before the Romans come in and brutally create a different kind of dynamic with their huge empire. That Hellenic culture, it never could resolve the what's true and what's a lie. It couldn't end the endless arguments that visual space had evoked, had caused a split. So Augustine comes along after the Roman Empire, well after the Hellenic period, 400 AD, and he's trying to resolve the endless arguments on behalf of Christianity. So he says this abstract point that the alphabet created, we'll call that the soul. And so he created the idea of an individual psychology, an individual soul, and that's what brought, that solved the classical, they called them the classical antinomies. The endless debate and never got resolved of pagan oral culture, once visual, alphabetic, and manuscript culture was around long enough, you know, 800 years, it had a general effect of creating an abstract effect in the mind, a schizophrenic effect, and Augustine turned it into an art form. He said, that is the image of the soul. People did not have a sense of the abstract soul the way the Christian literate societies have, and it began with Augustine. Now, isn't that an amazing insight? Right there.
It is.
Because what happens when you take drugs and you get an electric age? I had this discussion with Cameron McEwen, a good McLuhan scholar, and I said the environment is raw percept as opposed to schizoid concept or abstraction. He said, no, we always have concept in there. So we have this debate about how much is concept still there within our percept. But overall, most people go around being mouth breathers and just agape at trying to absorb all this stuff that's directly coming right into their guts, right into their eyeballs, these laser beams of information. It's not being reflected off the page like the book page is. It's light reflected off the page. This is going straight through your laser eyes and your guts. You're just swimming in a – you're swimming. And so it's very hard to get perspective or to get visual space. And so today, people don't have a literate soul. That's why God died. The literate part of the God effect of literacy is not livable in the electric age. So people fell to meditation or just some kind of immerse yourself in some kind of sensory experience or be outraged at all sensory experience and try to remove yourself either through suicide or be a wandering, homeless, indifferent person like the Indian monks. So raw percept killed the Christian religion, and it was done by media, electric media. Another amazing thought.